You're listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense with your host, Doug Thorpe. Here's Doug.
Welcome, everyone. This is another episode of Leadership Powered by Common Sense. I am your host, Doug Thorpe, and today we've got a special guest that is going to talk to us about how you might go about building a $100 million purpose-driven brand. That's a mouthful to say, but my guest is going to help us break that down. His name is David Dressler. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so as is kind of become our tradition, why don't you start us off by giving folks just a kind of a little bit of rundown on your journey in business and life to get you to this point today.
Sure, Doug. I grew up spending my summers at a hotel in upstate New York. It was owned by my aunt and uncle. My mom worked three jobs to keep a roof over our head and keep us in meals. And so summertime was not a vacation for her, and therefore there needed to be some place for me to go. My aunt and uncle were happy to get some child labor out of me. So I took a Greyhound bus from Montreal, where I lived, to Lake Placid, New York, and worked for the summer, carrying bags and pouring coffee and renting the canoes and, you know, doing odd jobs. And so as I grew up spending my summers there, I had an inculcation into the world of hospitality. And when I got to be a teenager and I was thinking about where to go next, I had uncles who had been in hospitality. My aunt and uncle in Lake Placid had set a stage for me. So I went to study, got an education in hospitality in Switzerland and in management, and came back to America and started my career with Hyatt Hotels. Worked for Hyatt for a number of years, every conceivable management job. Then went to Four Seasons Hotels, where I worked in the luxury business for a long time, predominantly in food and beverage management. And somewhere in there, I started to feel like there's something more to my career that's not about working for others. And as I looked up the food chain, though there were many managers that I deeply admired and learned a lot from, I didn't want their job description. And so that started a process which eventually led me to Shutters on the Beach. I got headhunted to go there, which was the sort of last ditch effort of working for others, where I thought I could go be a big fish in a small pond, take my fancy experience and go work for an entrepreneurial type venture in the luxury hotel business. But that wasn't to be any better, I don't think, probably worse. But what came out of it was that I met two guys who were within 6 months of age of me, both also itching to become entrepreneurs, and we decided to jump ship together. We formulated a business plan, stealth style, and while working our job, met early mornings to put our vision together. Then I jumped ship first, started raising money. We raised $1 million and opened our first restaurant in June of 2006. An amazing adventure then started, where we continued to build, opening restaurant after restaurant based on the business plan that we had elaborated, our 10-year plan, and eventually opened 30 of them, a purpose-driven business, somewhere around 1,500 employees, operating in three states, and built a business that was based on incredible food, thoughtful service, an easy model to create a value proposition for the guest, and a purpose-driven culture. And that's what we did. In 2017, I started to think about replacing myself, and realized that the company had grown well beyond my skills, and that there were other people who could come in who were experienced. And that's what I did. I found my replacement and stepped away to help others. I'm now a full-time consultant and coach, advisor to purpose-driven brands, founders, as they scale. And I love doing what I do, and I wouldn't have it any other way, Doug.
Well, that's amazing, David. And you know, thank you for seeing that way clear. There's a couple things you packed in there right at the end that I want to get into. But before we do, I do want to dig a little deeper on this notion of what exactly did you consider purpose-driven business? Talk to us a little more about what that means.
Well, I think where it stems is that we all work for others. You know, I've heard you talk about your experiences, and we've all worked for the man. We've all worked for people that were and companies that we didn't necessarily find were meeting our own personal values. Or as we had more and more experience, we came to realize that those values were not quite the same. And so when the three of us got together to create our company, we had a vision, and that vision was that we were going to create the kind of place that we would want to work at. We were going to kind of create a company that valued people's contributions, that valued extraordinary product, that valued the contributions of everybody involved, and that created win-win outcomes for everybody in the ecosystem of the company. And so that's what we did. And if I look back on that, and if I look at our company or any company from 30,000 feet, I'm saying it starts with values. It starts with who do we want to be while we're doing the business of making the money that we're making? What do we stand for? What are the things that we'll leave money on the table for? What are our non-negotiables? And from there, what's the vision? What impact do we want to make? What's our dent in the universe? What are we going to do? From there, a mission, and then from there, a strategic plan to achieve it. And all of that strategic plan is based on our values, so that we hold ourselves accountable to something that's the reason we got into business in the beginning. And as we grow and as we find ourselves in that potential place of making compromises or getting away from those values, we can use those values as a barometer for our continued success.
I hear people out in the business world that profess to be really focused on purpose and value, and yet when you start talking to them, there's a disconnect there. They maybe have figured out some catchy, well-worded statement to put on the wall at the headquarters, but they're not pursuing anything that you could really call tangible value. So how do you think that in the process that you and your partners went through to kind of hammer that out, can you give us a little peek behind the curtain? What was the nature of your discussions as you were talking about what those core elements were going to be?
That's a great question, Doug. You know, there's a lot of that. We in the food business, we call it greenwashing. Everybody who uses the word natural, organically grown, sustainably farmed, there's a lot of gray area in the definitions of those words. And purpose-driven, you know, there's so much of that as well, that sort of languaging of the normal to make it sound like it's exceptional. And all I can say is that from our experience, like I told you earlier, we didn't want to create the kind of environment we had worked at where we had suffered. We didn't want to duplicate that and put a fancy name to it. We didn't want to put lipstick on a pig, as I think people say. We wanted it to be a special experience. And then from a product perspective, we grew up with the pedigree of fine product. My two partners are chefs. There was no way we were going to skimp on that. We had to figure out how to not skimp on it and offer it at a price that was affordable for people to eat 3 days a week so that we could do the volumes that we wanted to do. So If we came with a value proposition and said, okay, we need to price it so that people can do that, and we're not going to skimp on the quality, then how do we make it work? And the way that we made it work was by taking out the the hostess or the greeter or the bartender or the fancy plates and fancy glassware and fancy silverware. We used great solid products, but not the most expensive. We streamlined our service model. We did that so that we could put more value onto the plate, the food that people were eating. And in terms of creating a win-win outcome for everybody in our ecosystem outside of our team members and our guests, well, who does that leave? It leaves the investors. It leaves the community that surrounds the restaurant. And it leaves all of our suppliers, farmers, artisans. And we felt like, well, if at the end of the day, we can create a win-win outcome for each one of those, then everybody wins. And if everybody wins, then that's a company that everybody is going to love. And our first mission statement was restaurants people really love. And that's exactly what we wanted to achieve. We wanted everybody that was involved with us to say, yeah, this is a great place. It's a great place to do business with. It's a great place to work. It's a great place to go as a guest. And so I guess to answer your question succinctly, we started with that. We started with the idea of creating something special. We didn't start with something mediocre and say, well, how are we going to put spin on this to make it seem special?
Yeah. Well, I think many who might be listening know that the hospitality industry and restaurants in particular are incredibly challenging environments to work in. And obviously, you know, the food service business was front and center in the downturn with the pandemic and forcing everybody to stay home. There was a lot of collateral damage relative to that. And that aside, I think that industry still has traditionally had its own ebb and flows. For the run you guys had, how did you sort of sustain the ups and downs of what the economy might have been doing and how people were choosing to spend their discretionary money going out to dinner?
Well, we launched our company in 2006, and we all remember what happened in 2008.
Great timing, David.
Yeah, we were not strangers to recession, to hard time, to belt cinching. But what we found, particularly in 2008, when we only had two restaurants, one which was located right in the heart of Los Angeles and doing 1,000 covers or 1,000 customers a day. And then our second in the intuitive location, 2.5 hours away behind a decommissioned naval station in San Diego. what we found was that that one, which was suffering to find its legs, became our innovation lab. And we opened it there because we had somebody down there who we trusted implicitly to take the reins and run. And we knew that San Diego would be an amazing market for us, but we were hat in hand in terms of our appeal for landlords. And so we took what we could get, and it turned out to be an amazing location over time. But what we found with the economic downturn and our poorly sited location was that we really had to be innovative at every level. And so that moment in time caused us to be real crafty, scrappy, and we tried to stay that way in terms of figuring out the best way to do more with less without making everybody feel like that's the way that we were doing business. We still put our best foot forward in terms of our product. We still took care of our people, but we were very smart in terms of how we operated our restaurants. And the same thing happened in the pandemic. And thankfully, mercifully, I wasn't still in charge of the company because there were lots of horrendous decisions that had to be made. We ended up sending a lot of people off for a period of time, and that was very painful. The restaurants were closed, as you know, with the health department rules being what they were and our poor understanding of what the pandemic actually meant. And the first round being as severe as it was, restaurants were closed, forced to close, and stayed closed for a long time. And that required us to do a lot of different innovating that we hadn't done previously. and the team that did it were remarkable. And it was all about making sure that we could take care of the guests the best way that we could. In the early, you remember when it was like you couldn't get toilet paper in the store? Well, we were selling toilet paper. We were selling flour. We were selling eggs. We were selling anything that people could use that we could actually get on a wholesale level in market baskets. We couldn't sell our food, but we can sell ingredients so that people can cook. And people were appreciative of that.
Oh, yeah.
And then we started to sell people date night, a bottle of wine, some salami, some bread, some cheese, all in a basket, take it home, you know, be husband of the year. Or and then we started doing family meals as we could. So whatever we could to keep our own economic engine afloat, we did.
Well, I want to shift gears and go back to the sort of the creation of the idea and the evolution of the business. So you and your partners had your own little think tank about the vision and values you wanted to create and represent. How did you as a leadership team start developing that in the people you started to add to your team?
Well, it took us a long time before we grew on an infrastructure level. You know, we had one restaurant and a little spot upstairs that was our office. And then we opened a second restaurant, and Pete, who I mentioned earlier, and his buddy Ryan were running that restaurant. And then we started to raise more money and we started opening more restaurants. And we kept it pretty flat. You know, there weren't all kinds of people being hired to do marketing and finance. We were doing all of that, my two partners and I. HR was handled by me. But what we did do was make sure that we were hiring people at the restaurant level, both in management and at the line level, who could who were sort of representatives of our values. I think we did a pretty good job of interviewing people and bringing people on who got it. Inherently who got it and who were hardworking. So we understood what the competencies were for working at our restaurant early on. You got to be hardworking. You got to be a self-starter. You got to be somewhat independent, but you got to collaborate well. So that's who we were looking for, bright, shiny people who would just come in and work hard. And then as the company grew and as we realized we needed some help to grow it more rapidly, we did two things. We were early adopters of system development. So the only way that we're going to get this done is if we codify, memorialize, test systems that are going to be able to make it easy for the folks at the restaurants to do it well, that avoid repetitive tasks, that leverage technology, that make it bulletproof so we don't make mistakes. Because when you make mistakes and you forget certain things, there's hell to pay the next day. Not by us, but by the customer. You forget to order the chicken. Well, there's no chicken the next day. So everything needed to be systematized that could be. And then at probably around 7 or 8 stores, we actually codified our values and built them into our training. So we sat down with a woman named Barbara George who pulled out of us the language that we were busy using as examples to the people we were hiring. But because now we'd reached a certain size where we weren't hiring and training everybody ourselves, we needed a language in the organization that everybody could speak. And so we distilled our mission and principles, and we actually talked about them a great deal and fought over every single word and comma to make sure that they were as clear and clean as possible. And then we started making that the basis for our training, for our orientation, for everything that we did. And I'll say this because I think it's really important, Doug. We entered into a contract with everybody in the organization and said, it's not just us telling you and you saying to us, okay, we chef, you got it. No, if we ever do stuff that seems contrary to what we're talking about, you get to tell us. You get to remind us of our values. If we're making business decisions or treating people in a way that goes counterintuitive to what we've talked about, you have a responsibility to say, hey, Dave, you may have missed this one, or you may have been asleep at the wheel on this, or you screwed the pooch on this one, and we need to go back and revisit it. And that way we're all accountable to each other.
That's great. And sort of opening the door for that kind of two-way dialogue is a great way to build a much stronger culture, because clearly a workforce that thinks it's a one-way street with the owners on high kind of coming down from the mountain with the stone tablets telling them how to operate, that works sort of at the start, but inevitably there is that gotcha when the owner slips or has a bad day, and the workers are looking around going, yeah, but he did it. Why, you know, what's, is that okay? And so having that open invitation to give you the feedback and give you the rise, I'm going through my mind here thinking of several, you know, famous name brands where the leadership has done something very similar, and chief of which is one I've got a little familiarity with down here in Texas, Southwest Airlines, and the famous founder, well, he was a co-founder, Herb Kelleher, you know, a gregarious character to say the least, but he had values that he really wanted to be sure everybody got, and one of which was, we're going to have fun running this airline. And it was a pretty wide open free for all in what the definition of fun might be, and I mean that in a good way, not in any kind of inappropriate way by any means, but it was pretty wide open.
Yeah, that was a great early read for me, reading his book, and hearing the level of connection that was existing between the team members of Southwest Airlines and the management of Southwest Airlines, that there was a spirit of we're all in this together. And the more we communicate, the shorter the gate time, and the shorter the gate time, the more on time we are, and the more on time we are, the more flights we fly, the less fuel we use. And I mean, it's like a win-win that starts with, let's just talk to each other. I think that's what it's all about.
Well, and one quick anecdote on that, not to get too far off your story. I have a good college friend who was pilot number 42 at Southwest Airlines. And he is now retired, but he told me the story one day. He got a call, personal call from Herb, said, hey, G, are you on schedule today? And he said, no, boss, I'm not. And he said, well, I need you to fly to, it happened to be San Diego, by the way. He said, I need you to fly to the hub out in San Diego. We've got some operational issues out there. And my friend said, well, boss, pardon, but I'm a pilot. I don't deal with the ops per se. You know, I'm a consumer of our operations, but I don't tell them how to run their, you know, they're part of the business. Herb said, yeah, I know. He said, that's not what we're going to try to do. He said, I'm going to give you a plane. It's going to be loaded with barbecue pits and barbecue, and I want you to go have a party. He said, I happen to know you have a reputation as a pretty good party guy, and I want you to fly the plane out there, and you have the party. And he goes, well, okay, that I can do. So they called all these guys together, not to read them the riot act or not to, you know, criticize the flow, but Herb had the good sense to feel like they had just, as a team, they had lost their cohesive connection. So he threw them a party, and they spent a Saturday afternoon, you know, having this party out on the tarmac with a bunch of barbecue. And I'm sure there were a few beers involved, and nobody was on the flight line, so let's get that straight. But, you know, they had this party, and next thing you knew, it was one of the most efficient operational units in the whole company.
Great story.
So there are those kind of creative ways to get that done. And I tell you what, Dave, on that note, I'm going to take a short commercial break. We're going to insert a little message here, but then we're going to be right back and dive more into your story about the $100 million purpose-driven brand. We'll be right back.
Business is all about solving complex problems as fast as you can create them. Become the best problem solver by leading others to greatness too. And the first step is going to DougThorpe.com. Doug Thorpe is known globally for coaching entrepreneurs and business leaders, improving their performance and the work output of everyone surrounding them. You can find health, wealth, and happiness by learning to lead others to health, wealth, and happiness. Go to DougThorpe.com now and order Doug's books or hire him to coach your managers. That's Doug, T-H-O-R-P-E.com.
All right, everyone, we're back. Thank you for taking a pause with us. We are meeting with David Dressler, and he is talking to us about his experience with a couple of partners building a purpose-driven brand. While we were on the break, David and I were talking a little bit about that notion of, let's visit again this idea of what is purpose-driven. I made the comment that often when I speak to business owners, they're a little puzzled by that in a fashion. They kind of go off on a tangent of saying, are you telling me I have to be some kind of maybe faith-based or heart-based or some fuzzy, squishy, you know, fluffy kitten kind of idea? And I don't look at my business that way. And I think the answer is no, that's not what we're talking about. So, Dave, give us your view on that.
Sure. I'd love to. And I'll tell you, just so that I'm not completely off base here, I want to be candid with you. Our company is in Southern California. And so in Southern California, the idea of heart-centered, purpose-driven might also include some yoga and some meditation and some mindfulness classes and getting some Tibetan monks to come in and bless the restaurant. I mean, those things actually happened in our company. But at its core, the idea of servant leadership or purpose-driven management of a company is really just about care. At the end of the day, if we work for our team members and our mission, our mantra, as it was for us and is very much for me today, make it easy for them to do great, then we're putting ourselves in the position of roadblock remover, of teacher, of guide, as opposed to authoritarian boss, oligarch, whatever. We're putting ourselves in the position of saying, okay, I run a company and the vast majority of the effort comes from the people who are delivering the product or service or making the product and service. That's where all of the effort is happening. And in the office that supports that, there's lots of mind stuff happening. There's lots of planning that's taking place. There's lots of strategy that's taking place. And that's not to downplay its importance on any level. But the successful businesses are the businesses where both are equally respected. But at the end of the day, the ones who have the sweat running down the side of their face need the most encouragement because they have it the hardest. They're in front of the guests. They're on the firing line. They're in the arena. And so if I can tilt my business towards that by saying, okay, how am I going to make it easy for them to do great? How am I going to innovate to make it easier? How am I going to innovate to make it more fun? As we talked about with Herb Kelleher and Southwest, how are we going to innovate to make it a better place to work so that we are satisfying our team members to the greatest degree possible with their sense of pride, their sense of wellness, their ability to earn and support their families, their ability to advance and to move up, and their ability to learn new stuff, take on greater responsibility, and therefore advance. Then we're on to something.
Yeah.
And that is me saying, okay, I want this person to stick around because they're a great worker, but I also want them to exercise their full potential while they're here. and grow in the organization. Because as long as my organization is growing, there's more and more positions of authority or of responsibility that I need filled. And if I can fill them internally with those people, then not only are they winning, but the organization is winning because they're the best trained individuals we have.
You know, you've said a couple of things that remind me, and just to summarize where I'm getting ready to go, is this: what I'm hearing in your story is a good blend of left brain, right brain coming together. So, you know, the right brain gave you this sense of purpose and value and what some may call the more relational aspects of the kind of company you want to be. But at the same time, you described going after the creation of systems that could make it scalable and reliable and sustainable, like ordering the chicken for the next day, you know, getting that systematized so that you didn't make a mistake and you didn't goof on that. And I've, in my own business advisory work, I've developed a simple three-part program that's very similar to this. It's an alliterative description. It's people, process, and profits. Everything about a business kind of falls in one of those three buckets. You described the activity that you and your partners went through to define this framework of purpose and values. So you went after people that could fulfill that. You described a very rigorous talent acquisition effort to really check people's spirit and check people's motivations to be part of that team. And then you described the creation of these processes. And you just a moment ago mentioned the idea of somebody was in the back room crunching the numbers and tracking things and adding the mind science to the viability of the company to keep things front of mind and keep things moving in the right direction. So it's ultimately quite an orchestra you put together to make this happen, right?
No doubt. And whereas we may have started off as jacks of all trades and masters of none, we eventually saw the need to bring some Jills on board and to specialize as the company grew, so that we made sure that the best person was in the best job. When we could do that internally, that was amazing. And when we had to bring somebody from outside because we didn't have that skill set apparent, then again, that same rigor around finding the right person for that job who brought the expertise that we were lacking, but who represented the values that were important to us, the kind of person we'd want to sit and have a meal with. Then we knew that we were bringing somebody in who would honor the people who are coming in, or who are already here, as opposed to saying, well, here's why your business is messed up and here's what I'm going to do about it, which often happens.
I'm going to put you on the spot, Dave. I give you fair warning. So for all the great things that it sounds like you and your partners were able to pull off, what might have been your biggest aha moment when you realized something about what you were trying to do was not quite going the way you wanted it to, and you had to pull up or shift gears or recorrect? I don't know what the right word may be.
How much time do you have, Doug? It could be like 10 volumes of episodes. But listen, for all the great things we did, we made our fair share of mistakes in terms of undervaluing the role of marketing, for example, or keeping people who it turns out didn't have that same value system over time, and keeping them too long out of a sense of obligation, or having people who had the value system but didn't have the technical skills or ability, and we kept them out of loyalty, where we should have pulled the trigger sooner. There were times where we probably knew something was a hard no, and we kept it a soft maybe for too long. Those are the things that I think were the biggest ones. The the hard decisions that we put off, even though if we really trusted our gut, we would have reacted faster.
You know, and thanks for sharing that. The one about keeping people too long, I have to tell you, almost I'd make a statement that almost at 100% of every entrepreneur I've ever talked to has had a story about that in their history book on their business, that there's something about that person that maybe came on early and was a significant player in the development of the company, but as things matured and got on track, proved not to be the right fit for the new direction or the advanced direction of the business. Yet the owner hung on to him because of that. Maybe it was, call it loyalty, call it appreciation, call it camaraderie or whatever. But a person that really ends up being a bit of a drain and potentially a pretty major distraction to the ongoing success. And it's a hard call to make, and it sounds almost heartless to just sit here and talk about it that way. But it is a lesson that, as I said, just about every entrepreneur I've ever known, I was guilty of it in my business. It's a story that's out there.
Well, Doug, there's two things I'll say. The first is, when we keep somebody for too long, we're not only doing our company a disservice, but we're doing that person a disservice because they're doing a mediocre job at the job that they're doing. And that's making them suffer. It can't feel that great to not be doing your best work because you've reached a level of unconscious competence or conscious incompetence where you're just not the right person for that job anymore. That can't feel good. And so we're preventing that because we don't want to have that hard conversation. And they don't want to be told it's time. Then they have to go find a new thing. But I know a lot of folks who I've had these conversations with, both in my company and elsewhere, where they've gone on to have much happier professional lives as a result of this one moment. And I've received some thank yous for that. The second thing is that it's not just the people in the organization. If I'm being completely honest, there are many times where I didn't feel like I was the right guy for the job. And some of that may have been imposter syndrome. Some of it may have been a little bit of laziness on my part, or focusing on the wrong thing, or not wanting to make that hard call, or being a little bit in over my depths, or just tired. You know, you build a business, as we all know, the entrepreneurs listening, it's like pushing an elephant up a mountain. And so, there were times where I probably, if I'm being completely honest, should have replaced myself. And I did replace myself three times with more professional and experienced people. But if somebody is running a company and listening to this and thinking, am I really the right person to do the job? There's a conversation there. And I'm sure, Doug, you've had this many times, whether this is imposter syndrome, a time for you to focus on something new, or maybe you just need a vacation for a little while and you need to go back to school and get a mentor who can help guide this next step of your evolution.
Right. Well, you raise a phenomenal point, Dave, in terms of the plight of the entrepreneur. You know, the founder syndrome is one of the hardest aspects of entrepreneurism that is out there. And typically, the majority of the cases, the founder develops a certain kind of pride. At first, it's usually a healthy pride. You know, you are the champion of your idea. But as the company takes off and grows, there's always the possibility that it is going to surpass your capacity to be the leader of that enterprise. And you might still be the idea guy, and you might still be the bit of a, call it, heartbeat of the company because you wrote that original purpose statement. But the capacity to effectively lead may require another skill set that you don't have. And the smart entrepreneur embraces that and says, for the good of the company and for the good of this thing I've built, I am going to go find that guy that can fill that gap. And I will go sit in my visionary seat, and I'll keep cranking vision and keep singing the fight song for the for the organization, but I will go find another leader that is better suited to what we need to do next. And that's great wisdom on your part, Dave, for realizing that.
There's two pieces of that. You know, you mentioned pride, which I think is absolutely true, both the good kind and maybe the misguided kind. But also, one of the feelings that I had being the heartbeat of my company was a responsibility, a sense of like, well, if I were to move, who would take care of this? If I were to do what I truly most want to do, what my heart is telling me I need to do, that would be me kind of leaving them in the lurch. And that's a tough thing to struggle with, but I think there's certain ways to around that. And one of the things, because you mentioned heartbeat, is that if we build our culture strong and right, based on our values, and we encourage people to feel that sense of ownership and that feeling of heartbeat, what I recognized as I stepped away was that there were many hearts beating in the organization that were representative of the values that I espoused, that my partners and I came up with as being the hallmarks of the company. There were many people in the organization at all levels whose hearts were beating strongly and who together could form a much bigger heart than even mine.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, Dave, this has been phenomenal. I really appreciate you sharing. Is there a link or a website or something you can share if people want to get a hold of you and hear more of the story?
I appreciate it, Doug. So if you're interested in hearing more about the story, my partner, Eric Oberholzer, and I wrote a book called 10-Year Plan. It tells the story of how we created our purpose-driven and heart-centered brand. Good, bad, and ugly. We're pretty candid about our successes and our failings. And we wrote it to provide a little founder's therapy for the two of us, but also because we promised ourselves that if we had a story worth telling, that we'd tell it. So we wrote it down as a story that could help purpose-driven leaders see around the corners as they scale their brands. And so I invite everybody to pick up a copy. And then if you'd like to work with me either on the coaching side or on the advisory side for your business, quietadvisory.com.
Great. Great. Well, again, thank you, Dave, for these this story and all these great and valuable tips and ideas. I really encourage everyone to maybe use this as a little bit of a gut check for where you might be in your own business or career, for that matter. If you have maybe been on the treadmill a little too long and you've kind of lost sense of that original purpose, no time like the present to kind of get back in touch with that. And maybe if you've been out there slugging away and you've never really spent the time, like Dave described, to define that, really hammer out a literal written definition of what that needs to be about and embrace the core elements of it. Again, no time like the present to stop everything, go get in your choir room or wherever you go to do these sort of things and make it happen. So one last time, Dave, thank you so much for being a guest.
My pleasure. Great being with you.
I do want to remind everyone that if you're listening on audio, we do have a video version of this over on our YouTube channel by the same name, Leadership Powered by Common Sense. It's been a pleasure having you here and sharing this time with us. I hope to see you again real soon. We'll say bye-bye.
You've been listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, hosted by Doug Thorpe. If you would like to know more about the coaching and advisory services he provides, visit DougThorpe.com.